Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Identity Unveiled. I'm Shweta Pillai, co-host and co-founder of this platform that's dedicated to bringing stories of Asian American women breaking barriers. In this episode, we spoke with Rena Van Tine. In 2001, she was appointed as associate judge for Cook County in the state of Illinois. This achievement set a precedent as she became the first female Indian American judge in the United States. Rena was born in India, and at the age of two, her parents decided to immigrate to the U.S. in search for better opportunities. Inspired by a close friend's mom, she decided to pursue a career in law and worked her way up to state court. What stands out about Rena's journey is a strong, resilient connection she has with what makes her different. She's a woman, she's brown, she sounds like, as one professor put it, a valley girl, but she doesn't hide those differences to fit in. As she eloquently shares with us in this episode, that what makes her different is what makes her memorable, and it's what makes her be seen. Today, she not only holds the achievement of becoming the first female Indian American judge in the nation to serve on a state court, but also celebrated a career milestone earlier this year when she became a circuit court judge of Cook County.
So I was born in Bangalore, India, and my parents and I literally came over on a boat. My dad had about 10 bucks in his pocket between the three of us, and my mom was pregnant with my little sister at the time. So I was about 2 years old when we moved here, actually here meaning to New York. And like a group of nuns actually took in the family. My mom, when she arrived, she had a sari and flip-flops on with about a foot and a half of snow in upstate New York. Wow. So she was like stepping through the snow with, really not equipped for it. But these nuns found us like some housing, and my dad ended up getting a residency at St. Joseph's Hospital in New York. So I was, when I was very young, I was in New York.
So were your parents coming over for the job opportunities? Is that what brought them over to immigrate to the U.S.?
So, I think so. They thought that there were better opportunities here. At the time they came over, it was really more fashionable to go to Europe, but they were like among the first wave of people coming here, like in the early 60s. So they were hoping for better opportunities, which they got, because I'm very fortunate. If I hadn't been born into the family that I was born into, who pretty much raised me to think like, you can do whatever you like, even though they were kind of shocked at first I'd go into law as opposed to like a nice stable field like medicine or engineering, they came around. But so we were in New York for a while, and then we moved to Kingston, Ontario, Canada. So I was in Canada through a little bit of grade school, and my parents were wondering whether they should go back to India. At least back then, they were like thinking that they were going to go back, because there really wasn't anybody who looked like us here. As the years went on, like about 10 years later, if we saw somebody in the grocery store in a sari, my mom would just run over to her and invite her over for dinner. They were very excited.
It was important to have that community, right? My parents actually came in the 60s as well. My dad moved to Wisconsin, and I remember there was this, it was very important for them to kind of find that Indian community to relate to.
I imagine
there was some bout of homesickness to be around.
Definitely so. I think they always planned returning, actually. So, but we would visit, we went back, and I really liked being in India. I loved being in Bangalore with all my cousins and, people who look like me. And, at one point, like in fifth grade, I asked them, well, could I just stay here? So they thought like, oh, this is good, because eventually, this way she doesn't get too anglicized or westernized. She could stay here. in the family, and then we will return. So I live with my grandmother for part of the time. I live with my aunt and did 5th, 6th, 7th, and most of 8th grade there. So I went to an all-girl Catholic school, a private school there. And, I had to catch up because, my mother tongue was Tamil. But then when I moved to India, I had to take Hindi as a second language. Although the school was a British school, so it was taught by a lot of nuns. So it was taught in English, but I had to take Hindi and learn the script and Sanskrit as a third language. So, but then, I was also visiting my parents at that point. My dad was a practicing surgeon. My mom, she got her PhD. She ended up being dean of Oakland University's library, which is a school, University of Michigan, in Michigan. That was later. But before that, I realized that they were not moving back. I think they realized they were not moving back, but they still gave us a choice, both me and my sister, to stay wherever we want. And I always felt like I fit in better here eventually, and she felt better like over there. So even now, she still lives in Bangalore, but I moved back to the United States and stayed here through high school, returned to New York, went to law school in New York. But then I've been here in Chicago since December of 85. So now I feel like, okay, I'm from Chicago at this point. So
let me ask you though about your decision to go to law school. So your mother was in the academic field. Yeah. And what was she, a professor?
She was like dean of Oakland University's library. So she's an administrator. So
okay.
She ran the library.
And then your father was a surgeon.
Correct.
So what prompted you to go into law?
He's got several sisters and a brother that were all physicians also. A number of their kids were physicians. So, and a number of cousins are engineers also. So they were really successful at it too. So I just wanted to do something different rather than compete with the rest of the family. And also when I was in college, my college roommate, who ended up being maid of honor at my wedding years later, her mother at that time was in law school. So we were like all kind of studying at the same time. So she graduated law school before we graduated college. So that was the first lawyer I had ever seen. And back then, it was very unusual for women to be lawyers. And she just had the cutest shoes, these patent leather shoes, and she bought herself like this pink Cadillac. That was like, wow, I'd never seen anything quite like that. I went to court with her, and she was so much older than all the men. To her, like all the men were just boys. So this boy was doing this, this boy was doing that, and she was not intimidated by anybody, because they were all like, her son's age or daughter's age. So I saw her really enjoy her job. The work was interesting for her. And I thought, well, the law degree, that opens doors to a lot of things.
So you go to Oakland University in Michigan, and then you went to New York Law School.
I did.
So what was your first job out of law school?
First job out of law school, I worked here in Chicago. It was a small law firm that did real estate closings primarily, also wills. I did some personal injury work on the plaintiff side. I did some criminal misdemeanor defense on the defense side. It was kind of funny. I chose that law firm more for the real estate closings, but found that I really liked being in court. And, when I was in law school, though, I had a law professor tell me, oh, sweetie, you talk way too much like a valley girl. You'll never make it in court. And so, I think he said, I think you're a good negotiator. You should go into, a field like real estate.
It's like that legal Blonde movie with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, you know, it didn't fit the mold. I think that's how I was. I didn't fit the mold of what a lawyer looked like back then. So I don't think he necessarily, and he wasn't like, actually, I don't think he was trying to be mean. He was trying to fit me into where he thought I would be, you know, bust off somehow.
But so how did you get, though, from New York to Michigan? Like, how did you find, you know, because one of the questions I hear from some of my friends that are in law school is just those getting, like, when they look at your career and you become a judge, they're like, well, how did those opportunities kind of open up? Like, was it just you apply, there's an opening, or was there someone that, you know, kind of helped you get land that opportunity over there in Michigan?
Michigan.
Oh, in Illinois. Sorry, you were in Illinois. Yeah, Illinois.
I was practicing in Illinois. The first one, I just sent resumes out blind, and then people interviewed me. I interviewed, you know, I tried to assess like where I would be the best off. And I thought, oh, here's a practice that it was like located, it's no longer there, but it was located right on Devon Avenue, which is the heart of the Indian neighborhood here. So I thought, oh, you know, here's a chance to work in immigration. But it turned out like most of the clients knew more than I did back then on the immigration stuff. But I really liked being in court. And then I had this very contested case against an African-American state's attorney, female state's attorney, but we always got along. And then, you know, she was like, you know, you should really apply to the state's attorney's office. People can use skills like yours. Mm-hmm. And so I sent in my resume, and it took about almost a year for them to get to it, because I didn't know anybody at all in the office. But then she also gave me a recommendation, even though she's opposing counsel on the other side. So, you know, I interviewed, and I still remember that interview. There were like all these people in navy blue suits and white collar, and I was like the only one in like this dark silk blouse with a beige suit on. So I just, if I didn't stand out enough already, like just even my clothing was, you know,
right.
So, but I, you know, interviewed, and I went through the series of interview. They cut me a break, even though I only had this one recommendation. And, you know, I started in the state's attorney's office, which is really great training ground to be a judge, because you are always in court.
When did you know that you wanted to become a judge?
I think at some point in the state's attorney's office, you know, I think within about between 5 to 10 years into it, I knew. I think that was, it's just sort of a natural extension of public service too. I enjoy being in a courtroom. I thought that was the next step for me in government service. Here in Cook County, a number of former state's attorneys and public defenders end up on the bench just because you know, we're the people who are in court the most. So a number of my friends also, you know, ran for judge, and I worked on different judicial campaigns, and, you know, I enjoyed doing that. And then, you know, staying in touch with them after they got onto the bench and just seeing like what a great job it was. I just thought like, oh, that's like the next thing. You know, these guys can all do it. I could try to do it too.
Becoming a judge is a very rigorous process. But in that process, you got married, you had your daughter.
Yes,
Kristen.
One time, yeah.
So how did you kind of balance the commitments of the demands of becoming a judge, of being a judge, and marriage and having a child?
Well, I got married like relatively young. I think I was probably the first of my group of friends to, you know, get married at, you know, 26. And so I, you know, I've been married about 34 years now. So the first 10 or so were like really devoted to more to like the marriage. So that part of it, there was a lot of traveling, you know, it's not as much of juggling schedules then. There were times where like, oh my goodness, we, you know, my husband and I ran into each other at O'Hare Airport because he was going on some deposition somewhere and I was going on like another deposition somewhere else. You know, we would just, you know, so those were like very busy times. And then I thought, like, oh no, you know, the age is like getting up there too. So I'm thinking, like, oh, I should, you know, we should have, if we're going to do this, we should do this soon, because there's never like a convenient time, right, to have a child when you're, you know, working. But, mm-hmm. you know, that was like the best decision ever, because, you know, now we have, you know, my daughter who is also is going to law school in the fall. So
congratulations. Where is she going to law school?
Oh, here locally, University of Chicago Law School.
That's great law school. I know that even in the process of becoming a judge, you know, breaking incredible barriers, are there organizations that helped you along the way in those efforts to become a judge?
I think so. You know, the Asian American Bar Association, you know, I'm a past president of that, and the South Asian Bar Association, which is a bar association that I co-founded. Members of both those organizations were, I think, very encouraging. You know, I don't think we even knew what we were getting into. In the Asian American Bar Association, at that time, I chaired the Judicial and Legislative Committee. And in, I think it was like 96, there was like this area that half of Devon Avenue was in it. So half of the Indian neighborhood in Chicago was in it. So mm-hmm. they knew I had worked on different judicial campaigns. And so there was like other members of the Asian Bar said, you know, you really should run there because like nobody's ever run in that area before. So why don't you try doing that? So, you know, I ran, but then as soon as I filed my petition papers, I found out I was pregnant and it was like a high risk pregnancy. So the campaign took a back seat. I didn't really campaign. I wasn't out there as much as I should have been. And then also like the Devon, I didn't realize at the time that it was so gerrymandered that they cut the neighborhood in half. So only half of the Indian neighborhood was in the section that I was, you know, running in. But so I lost that election. But I do have the daughter that's going to law school in the fall. So, and I ended up with the judgeship in the long run. So, you know, it was a really great, great decision.
You've also been married 34 years.
Yes,
happily. So what's your secret?
I think part of it is luck that you find somebody that is going to change and grow with you. You know, I don't think I'm exactly the same person that, you know, that I was at 26, even though, you know, sometimes I feel like I am. But, you know, I think as you age and mature and, you know, interests can change, I think I was lucky that I have a spouse that has always been very supportive of anything that I wanted to do and, you know, who like kind of grew and changed with me. Plus, we're very close with my daughter, too. So, you know, I think that's nice to have a child also that brings you together.
There's a study actually that came out called The Social Realities of Indian Americans. And one of the things that they state in there is that Indian Americans have the highest rate of endogamy among Asian American communities. Huh. So when you married Matt, was there whispers about you marrying outside of the community?
I think my parents always thought I would marry in the community, but when that wasn't happening, like to me, I thought I was getting married very young at 26. I'm like, right. Almost like fresh out of law school. I felt like I was very young to them. Like I'm like really old. Right. So it's like when I got married, they were just so happy that I got married to somebody, you know, it's like, my husband's like, he's great, you know, but then, you know, it helped. Like he's a Harvard grad and he's also a lawyer and, you know, he's a really, really nice person too. I mean, just really very supportive. And so I think, so my parents were very happy. And then at my wedding, like, you know, my parents' friends' kids that I grew up with, almost everybody was, I think everybody was like younger than me, but they would come up to me like right at the wedding and go, oh, thank you. You opened the door for us to bring that. <You know? laughs>
Imposter syndrome is something that many of us feel throughout our career. And I'm curious about how did you feel that? And if you did, how did you manage that?
I think I was very well aware that I really wanted to do a really great job because any little mistake could be magnified more. But if you do a really great job, you have a better chance of standing out for it because we look like the way we do. So I tried to use that. And then also, you know, even if there wasn't somebody, because
wait, Rena, you said you tried to use the fact that you look different.
Yes, because I could stand out. So just as my mistakes could, I realized like my mistakes could really stand out. If I was doing a really good job, I was hoping that would stand out too, because sometimes people would be like pleasantly, you know, they didn't know what to expect. I remember the first closing argument I did in court on a murder trial. Like all these state's attorneys that were supervisors plus, you know, other colleagues, they all came in to watch it. And they did my argument. And afterwards, everybody was like slapping me on the back and going, oh my gosh, that was just amazing. We never thought like you were that fiery, you know, that passionate about anything. Because I think I was, you know, I didn't come across as...
Because you were an Indian woman?
I'm not sure what it was, if it was gender, if it was race, or, you know, the mixture of the two, or just the way I carried myself. But like several people were really shocked. And then I got like better and better cases. And they even, there was one courtroom, I remember it in the felony trial courtroom, the judge in the courtroom back then, he would not allow any women or minorities to practice in front of him. But that was also a courtroom that I knew that when people got assigned there, they also got promotions in the office. So I really wanted to be in that courtroom. And they send a wish list around like, oh, where would you like to be assigned? You know, put your top three choices. So I listed this judge's name on all three choices. And so they were like, oh, you know, he doesn't really want that. And we have to make sure that we, you know, present our cases in the best light. And so I said, why don't you just give me one case, just one trial, and just see how it is. And, you know, they did. They gave me like one case to try in front of them. And then he was like very surprised. He was like, oh, she did a good job, you know? And so I was like, oh, judge, you know, I'm trying to get assigned to your courtroom. You know, is there any way like you'd give me a chance? And so he let me go in kind of on probation, you know, but then we ended up getting along just fine. And he really liked the job I was doing. So, but then he's deceased now, but, you know, he retired. But, you know, he really liked me a lot when I was there. And it also opened the door for more women and minorities to practice in his courtroom. Then when I was like running around trying to become a judge and get support from all of the sitting judges, even though he was retired, he came back into the courthouse and went to lunch with like his good old boys network, like all these good, you know, like these voting judges, and said, oh, you know, she's okay. You know, you should vote for her. So, I mean, I just tried to get the support, you know, just because somebody is a, you know, different gender or different race, or and even a different, you know, wildly different political group, doesn't mean that they may, that they won't support you. And likewise, just because somebody is in your same political party and is the same gender and the same race, that doesn't automatically mean that they will support you. So I try to look for like lateral supports. Like I didn't have anybody that really looked like me coming through, but I just tried to look at where I could have support. So the network of African-American jurists those judges were very supportive of me. And so ever since, like, 20 years ago, I got on the bench, one of the first things I did was join the Bar Association here, the Illinois Judicial Council, which is the network of African-American judges, because that network, even people who I had not practiced, you know, with, I would just appear before them for interviews and they liked me. There's like some commonality in the experiences that we shared. So they helped me, you know, people who haven't even known me. So,
you know, so you found commonality with working, you know, finding some alliances with other minority groups.
I do. Yeah. Even now, even now.
What do you think, Raina? I love hearing how you went for the jugular. You were very strategic in your lateral move. And going up the ladder at a very early age, getting into that courtroom, you know, to this judge, what do you think it was that you had to push through on? What type of bias were you fighting? And why was it so difficult?
I think he had a strong preference for people who looked like him. So it was only like white men that had ever been assigned to the courtroom. Those were the people he felt comfortable with. Those are the people he felt he could trust. And I think the office went along with it because they like to keep each judge kind of, you know, happy because they want to put the best case forward. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of this story that we have the first Illinois Supreme Court justice who was female was also a Cook County assistant state's attorney in the office. And she was a very good writer, like early on. And she wrote this great brief, did all the work on it, and it was scheduled for hearing in the Supreme Court. But her supervisors decided that she could not argue it because women didn't argue in the Illinois Supreme Court then. So she was taken off the case and it was given to a male counterpart to do the whole argument, even though she did the entire workup of the case. She wrote the brief. And then, you know, she eventually became a Supreme Court justice. So it's, it didn't, you know, I saw that. It's like, it didn't stop her. I think it probably made her more sensitive to the issues that women encounter in law. So I don't think I'm alone as like a female lawyer getting mistaken for, you know, the court reporter, the clerk, the secretary, anybody with the attorney on record, right? You know, so now I wear a black robe and the guy with the gun tells everybody to stand so nobody confuses me for anybody else anymore. But so back then it was different.
Go ahead, Diane.
With that being said, what I'm hearing is that, you know, what was forged in the fire through the cultural gender biases helped the ascent to your success. And how, as an Indian, you know, the heritage of being an Indian, what were those strengths that led you in the courtroom?
I think, I'm not sure if it's Indian or just family, but it's an Indian family. They encourage you to say what you think. Also perform, like for any weddings and stuff, you're expected to play the piano for everybody, or, you know, like everybody's trotting out their skills, whatever, you know, instrument they're good on, the violin, or if you didn't play anything, well, even if you did, you'd have to make up a nice little skit that could involve several relatives that was clever enough to entertain people, make up puppet shows, make up, you know, we did our own entertainment, and you're expected to get out there and, you know, present to like this whole audience, which is a very loving audience because it's our family and, you know, everything we did was wonderful. So I think that helped build some of the confidence too. So even if people laughed at what you were doing because you made a mistake when you were little, it was like kind of a loving laughter, you know.
So they really instilled a confidence in you to that it was maybe even okay to make mistakes.
Yeah, because no one can get anywhere without making mistakes, so you just have to learn from them.
So your daughter is now pursuing a career in the legal profession.
She is. Yes. She's going to be starting in the fall.
What's different for, like, when you entered into law, like, what do you see as being different for your daughter now that she's going into this profession?
I'm very hopeful for this generation of lawyers, including, you know, especially like the women lawyers. I think this younger generation is demanding more, and rightly so, like more work-life balance, more awareness. I think there's also more, you know, more women working together to try to support each other. The men too are stepping up to the plate in calling out, you know, sexist behavior. So, and that's also a function of having more women in the workplace and women who are, you know, able to point out things that they might be doing that they're not even aware of that are sexist. So I think that's probably helps. That makes it different, just the virtue of having more people here. Like even in the like an Asian American community, when we get hired out of law school, there are more Asian Americans that get hired in large law firms than African Americans or Hispanics. Yet there are fewer that actually make partner in these large law firms. So what is happening here? You know, so there is not that there's some sort of disconnect happening. But I think hopefully, you know, as more people make it, they will turn around, reach back and help the next person on. And so they have to do that or else, you know, the people will just drop out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm in the finance world and I see that as well. I'm a huge proponent and very passionate advocate about putting more Asian women in senior executive positions. You know, mm-hmm. we're leading as a majority in the minority world in finance. Mm-hmm. A big gap and drop off is when they hit that executive partner or executive position. It's not there. So same
thing. Yeah, because I think it's the same kind of mindset where they might be seen as, oh, a nice person and a really good worker bee, but is she really a leader?
Yeah.
Who can like run the team? You know, that's like, we have to shift that mindset.
One of the things that when you talk about surrounding yourself with people who are supportive of your career, and it's being very intentional about that, mm-hmm. I think that's a piece where building allies in the workforce is an area of growth for seeing more women. And also just breaking down the stereotype where just because she may be more introverted and has more introverted preferences doesn't necessarily mean that that makes her a poor leader.
Yeah.
So there's work on both.
Yeah, that ally portion is really important. I know even after I became a judge, you know, we'd have these monthly meetings with a group of other judges for, you know, my assignment. And sometimes I would say something. It didn't get acknowledged, but somebody else would say the exact same thing. And everybody would be like, and the
mansplaining,
you know, the head judge, you know, the presiding would be like, oh, yeah, you know, this Judge Man A had like this great idea. And so I pointed it out like separately, like I had lunch one-on-one with another judge who is Caucasian. And I said, have you ever noticed that happening to me? You know, because it was kind of like a say, and he's like, no, you know, I haven't. And I said, just watch, you know, and if it mm-hmm. does, would you like just credit me with it? Okay. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, because we were good enough friends to say that. I had helped him with different things and helped him think through decisions. So there was like a level of respect and friendship there. And you know what? He did. Like the next meeting, it like happened again. And he was like, oh, yeah, that was Rena's idea. She said this, you know. And so I think, even though like I didn't have enough like women at that level to say something, you know, I had a male white judge who spoke for me. So I think it goes back to, you know, trying to identify people, somebody, you know, in there, because even one person can make the difference. You know?
What's next for you?
So recently, in February of this year, the Supreme Court elevated me to a circuit court position.
Congratulations.
So, yes. I resigned as an associate judge to take the circuit court position. So I'm hoping this is the next step in my development. Here in Illinois, we have no justices on the appellate court who are Asian American. To serve by assignment on the appellate court, you have to be a circuit court judge, not an associate judge. Even though our roles are the same, we hear the same cases, you know, my assignment didn't change, my chambers didn't change, my cases didn't change. But as a circuit court judge, you do have more power in selecting the other associate judges. So now I have the power to vote. So associate judges, the kind I was before, you know, we had to get the vote of all of the elected judges, and I could never vote. So in the last 20 years, I've always been a strong advocate for diversity on the bench, excellence on the bench. And I could see people who were, you know, fabulous lawyers who would have made, you know, great judges, but I could not vote for them because I was not a circuit court judge, but now I am. Same with the chief judge. The chief judge, he is elected by all of the circuit court judges, but not the associate judges. So this is like another thing that I get to do now, is vote on who the leadership of the court is. And so we're very underrepresented, you know, the Asian Americans on the circuit court. We have about 278 circuit court judges. Only four of us are Asian. So that's less than 2%.
You know? So I have to pause you on that, because what needs to happen to get more Asian representation at your level?
I think we have to not be afraid to take a risk. I had to resign my associate judgeship to take this position on the circuit court. And now I'm running in the June 2022 primary. So if I lose the primary, I would no longer be a judge. If I win the primary, then that opens a lot of doors for the community, as well as myself personally. So I think it could have been very easy to stay safe, because, you know, I have a job that I love, you know, what I do, but then it wouldn't have advanced anybody. And I'm the longest serving Asian American judge in Illinois. If I don't do it, who's going to do it?
That leads to our next question. You have so many powerful milestones that you've achieved and continue to achieve, and you have the power now to choose which way to go, which leads me, you know, to our last question. And what is a legacy that you want to leave?
I'm hoping that because of me and the community, more diversity will be reflected in our judiciary, especially more representation of Asian Americans. I think we're doing that to some extent at the associate judge level, but I'm hoping that if I'm successful in this election, maybe other people will be like, oh, see, she did it. Maybe I could do it too. You know? And so I think I want like more of our people to apply and try to get these judgeships, because the judiciary will be better for it. You know, people just lose confidence in the system if they don't see people that look like them. The system isn't as good if we don't have the perspectives of, you know, the people that we serve. So I really would like to try to open the doors for more people to be on the bench who are Asian American and other judges of excellence, you know, just to keep the, you know, try to expand on our diversity in our judiciary.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the stories on our podcast as much as we enjoy unveiling them to you. A lot of time and detailed editing goes into bringing these stories. A big thank you to our sponsor, Renica Digital. Renica Digital is a full-service digital marketing boutique offering cloud, web, app, and social media services. If interested in serving as an ally to help us continue bring stories to the spotlight, amazing Asian American woman trailblazers, please visit us at www.identityunveiled.org and reach out to us for sponsorship and donation opportunities. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. Until next time, be safe and be well.